Welcome to the MedTech Talent Lab, the number one catalyst for advancing careers and building high-performance teams. Sponsored by the Anthony Michael Group, helping companies secure in-demand talent in regulatory affairs, quality, clinical, engineering, R&D, and other areas for medical device, digital health, diagnostics, and other organizations across the U.S. life sciences sector. Here's your host, Mitch Robbins.
All right, welcome back to another episode here on the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. I'm your host, Mitch Robbins, and today I'm joined by Mr. Garrett Johnson, who is the brand new, within the last couple of months, CEO at Qantas Cardiovascular. Garrett comes to us with over 15 years, 16, I think, to be official at this point, years in the device space. As far as formal education, he did his bachelor's in biomedical engineering and his MBA from UC Irvine. He's worked for companies, those that used to be known as Covidien and EV3 prior to the acquisitions, Edwards Life Sciences, and really has specialties across medical device, design and fabrication, early stage R&D, new product development, project management, et cetera, having held positions basically across the entire R&D spectrum. And like I just mentioned, most recently, he's had the opportunity to become CEO at Qantas Cardiovascular, which is a startup working to create a novel left, you're going to have to bear with me here, ventriculoplasty device to help heart failure patients in need. So without further ado, Garrett, I hope I didn't botch that too much, but welcome to the show, man.
Yeah. Thanks, Mitch. That was a great intro. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, I'm so glad that you're here today, and congratulations, by the way. It's a big step for you, becoming the CEO of this startup in the heart failure space. And all the credit to you. You obviously deserve what you're doing, and you've built a storied career thus far, and that's why you're here today. So what I love to do, Garrett, if you're cool with it, is I love to go back in time, and I really like to start from the beginning as far as your formative years, where you grew up, things like that. Are you good with that?
Yeah, sounds great.
Awesome. So where did you grow up?
Yeah, so I grew up in Riverside, California, about an hour inland from here in Orange County. Pretty typical upbringing, nothing crazy. Growing up, I was really into motorcycles, and I still am. Mountain biking, really anything two wheels, so really involved in that kind of world, and that's what kind of sparked my interest in everything mechanical. And from a young age, like to tinker and build things and rebuilt my first car and all that kind of stuff. So the passion kind of started young there.
That's awesome. Yeah, I like to ask that kind of where the interest in what you do today for a living kind of came into play. Are you one of a few siblings, or are you an only child? Or
yeah, I have an older sister. She's 7 years older than me.
Okay.
She was in the kind of pharmaceutical world. So she's been in pharma sales for the last 25, 30 years. That was kind of my also peek into this world a little bit. Back when she started, there was a lot fewer kind of controls on what the sales reps can do and whatnot in the pharma world. And so, I remember vividly she had season tickets to the Lakers in like row 10 or something. It was right down amongst all the little, other celebs and whatnot. And when she didn't have to, use the tickets for a physician, I would get to use them. So I got some of the side perks as a young kid that she got.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You know, I come from a family of entrepreneurs, and my family had their own business in a couple different industries, but most notably in the cell phone industry, right? Okay. When cell phones, back in the very early 90s. And I remember there was a rep who took care of my family's businesses who would come around ever so often with season tickets to the Bulls. That's where I grew up, in Chicago. So nice. And that was when Jordan was still playing, and basically the dream five on the Bulls. So I know exactly what you're talking about, because we got to sit courtside a few times.
Very cool.
That's awesome. When you talk about your interest in motorcycles, are we talking racing bikes, or are we talking cruisers?
Yeah, racing. Yeah. So I had my first dirt bike when I was 3 years old, and grew up riding. My dad used to race dirt bikes back in the day. So I grew up riding, we always would, go camping and go to local tracks and whatnot. I got my first street bike when I was 16, and end up road racing throughout my 20s. So I'd go to, you know, closed circuits and had a few sponsors and whatnot. So pretty into it, pretty serious about it. I still ride in the track, and you know, now I actually race dirt bikes as well. So still riding as much as I can, as much as I can squeeze it in now. It's a bit harder now with, you know, kids and a startup and whatnot, but still riding when I can. Also really into biking. So for a while there, I was racing mountain bikes, and still do it for fun. So always really been into anything two wheels. And
that's awesome,
especially with a motor. So
yeah. My friend had a dirt bike when I was growing up, and I loved going to his house because he lived down on a ton of acreage and would let us ride with him and stuff. But I never, other than that, I never really got into it much, other than going to the shows where they do the huge jumps and stuff. I remember the kid who was it, Jeremy McGrath, I think, was. So that's awesome. Now, you talked about the fact that, you know, from a young age, you're into tinkering with things. You're kind of interested in how things were made, how they were built, et cetera. When you got into college, obviously you chose engineering probably for that reason. Did you know kind of once you were in school and you were going to school for biomedical engineering that you wanted to be part of this greater healthcare ecosystem and perhaps get into device?
Yeah, actually, when I went to UCI, I joined as an undecided, undeclared, they call it. So you don't really choose a major. You know, you kind of do the general stuff. I knew I either wanted to do biology or engineering. And at the time, biomedical engineering was really a new field as far as universities. I think I was the second or third graduating class from UCI in biomedical engineering. So it was brand new. The first year I was undecided, but kind of taking biology and engineering courses. And then my second year focused on biomedical engineering. Up until my fourth year, my plan was to actually go to medical school and everything. So I took the MCAT and, you know, was planning to apply, but I volunteered for a year at Hoke Hospital here in Newport Beach and, you know, on a bunch of different floors and whatnot. And really was turned off a bit by the bureaucracy of what doctors can do and whatnot, but always loved the technology piece of it and still wanted to help patients. And so I thought I could still make a, you know, large impact making devices rather than, you know, being in the clinic. So then went all in on engineering from that point on. And the rest is history.
That's awesome, man. I love hearing these stories because had you not had that volunteer experience in the hospital, you might have not, you know, your trajectory might have been completely different. Did you have an idea of what type of doctor you wanted to be at the time?
I like surgery. Yeah. So, you know, cardiac surgeon was kind of the goal. So I've always been really interested in, you know, the heart, but also the brain. So, you know, that's kind of my, we'll get into it, but, you know, I've done a little bit of neurovascular and structural heart. Surgery was what I was into.
Which is ironic because that's some of the two fastest growing areas, right? Right now? Cardiology and neurology. Right on, man. And so, you know, we talked at the beginning, the fact that you've pretty much seen every facet of R&D. You've been an R&D manager. You've been, you know, VP of R&D. Here you are, CEO, which is interesting because a lot of CEOs that I know, they come up from the commercial side, from CEOs from marketing background, not necessarily R&D. I'll get into that in a minute, but let's talk about the fact that, you know, I've said this so many times on our show here that you can aspire to be a top dog, so to speak, and you can never make it. And there's some people who do and some people who don't. And I have my own ideas as to why that is, right? You take two people, similar backgrounds, one excels in leadership and the other one just doesn't. Can you look at your own career and think through perhaps pivotal moments that helped you continue to reach new heights?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, the plan was from the beginning was never to be manager and, you know, VP and all that. You know, I was always into engineering. But when I was at EV3 Neurovascular, which was kind of the first, one of my first companies I worked for, I got the opportunity to manage a few people. And so, you know, I had two engineers under me and I was, you know, mid-20s. I was, you know, still a young kid. And I really took to it and kind of like empowering people and, you know, helping the team succeed. And And then after that point, I kind of thought, you know, maybe I want to go into the kind of management track. At that point, I decided to get my MBA. So I went to school for 3 years at nights when I was at EB3, getting my MBA. So that kind of gave me more of the business background and kind of the strategy piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've worked for CEOs that are, like you said, kind of more from the sales or marketing side than CEOs that are more engineering technical side. And I think pros and cons for both. But my favorite leaders that I look up to have always been kind of more technical engineering background, because I think you really need that. And if you can speak to the product and also the market, I think, and kind of, you know, have one foot in both arenas, it makes for a successful kind of leader.
So let's talk more about that. You said you got your first formal leadership opportunity in your 20s or so. Can you look back to that point? Like, if I asked some questions, can you remember at that point?
Yeah, definitely.
What do you think you did wrong at that time?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the two people that reported to me, one was an engineer about my age. The other was a contractor that they kind of brought on full time, but he was probably 25 years my senior. You know, he was a lot older. So that was a bit intimidating for sure. And I think earlier on, I was a bit more of a micromanager. I've since kind of changed my methodology, and I really believe in kind of empowering people and knocking down the roadblocks and letting them do what you hired them to do. But early on, I think I was a bit of a micromanager. So, you know, every little task, and I felt like I can do a lot of it myself faster. And so learning to, you know, teach someone to do something and then let them kind of stumble and get better at it. And then eventually they're the ones. And I think I carry that with me today a lot, because, you know, I feel like a lot of jobs, like, I'll just kind of jump in and do it real quickly, but then people don't learn that way, right? And you can't, as you grow larger and larger, you can't do everything. So I really learned kind of how to hand off and delegate, I think, in those early years.
That's a really great point. And it's nerve-wracking as a brand new leader to trust and to have that trust, because your track record is on the line as well based on the performance of your team. And let go of the reins too much, and you don't trust them, then it's for lack of a better term, it's your ass, right?
Yeah, definitely.
If you let go too much and you don't give them enough support, then, you know, the Indians rule the roost, or whatever it is, whatever the saying is. And so it is a fine balance. How did you learn how to ride that line as far as empowering them, but still being there to kind of help catch them if needed?
Yeah. I think setting guidelines or kind of, in insurance policies, if you will, you know, if something was behind a couple of days, you know, I would maybe ask about it, but not push too hard. If it's behind a week or 2 weeks, kind of like set those defined boundaries that, okay, now we need to bring in help or pivot or step in. So, you know, let people fail to a point, but you don't want to let people fall flat in their face. Right. So, you know, especially in R&D, right, you're going to fail 100 times and get one thing right. So it's kind of par for the course, I think, especially in very early R&D or if you're developing a new therapy, right? There's not always a defined roadmap.
For sure. And you've had the opportunity over the last several years to hire a variety of folks. From your perspective, what makes a really fantastic R&D engineer compared to an average?
Sure. I think someone needs to be hands-on. You know, you get a lot of people, for example, you know, some PhDs, for example, might have more of the theoretical background or whatnot, or they might come out of school first time in industry and approach things from a more academic perspective and less hands-on. So I always look for that hands-on. You know, whenever I interview an engineer, I always have a hands-on portion. You know, like, here's a catheter handle, can you take it apart? Or, you know, give them a test, like, how do you think this goes together? That sort of thing. A funny story kind of related to that. I remember when I was interviewing for cardiac valve technologies, interview process was to crimp and load the heart valve into the catheter, but with no instruction at all. So prior to that, I'd, you know, always been in neurovascular. So I had never even seen Heart Valve, you know, in person before. And the goal of it was to not be able to load the valve, but I was so persistent and kind of hard-headed with it. I took about 3 hours, I think. And I think I felt bad afterwards for the hiring manager because it was, you know, 8 o'clock at night at that point and he wanted to go home, I could tell, but I was determined to get this thing did. And I got it loaded in the catheter, and he was kind of blown away. Like, oh, you weren't meant to actually finish that. I more wanted to see how you think. But I kind of carried that forward as like always have a hands-on approach, which I think makes a great R&D engineer.
How would an R&D engineer not take a hands-on approach in their role? What do you mean by that? Meaning that they can know a bunch of the theory and a bunch of the academic piece, but not necessarily know how to implement?
Yeah. Some people, you know, you hear people say, oh, I was part of that project or I was involved in this, but really they're kind of arm's length to it, or they like maybe wrote the report, or they maybe, you know, were part of the team, but not really part of the design team. They were part of more like manufacturing or whatnot, which is also important. But, you know, I think just seeing how people work with their hands, or at least even think through a problem, or, you know, if you're made a bit uncomfortable, how do you, you know, do you reach out for help immediately? Do you quit? Do you get frustrated? So I think those are all telltale signs of someone's personality and how they deal with kind of the unknown and how they deal with stress. You know, you can really tell a lot by just giving someone a challenging hands-on thing.
Have you been able to vet that out pretty well during interviews?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I've had people that have really struggled, or someone that, you know, can hardly use a screwdriver, and you're like, how did you get your degree in engineering?
Wow.
And,
wow.
So it weeds out people pretty quickly. And kind of like my story, you know, they don't always have to get it perfectly right, but it's more the process of how they think through it. You know, they're asking the right questions. Are they thinking about it holistically, or just kind of giving up and say, oh, I don't know.
Yep. And I always suggest that, you know, in our world with recruiting, I always suggest a test drive is in essence what you are explaining. And that's where you take your top slate of candidates. It could be one, it could be two, you know, three at most. And you put them in as much of a real life scenario as you possibly can and see how they perform and see how they think, see how they, the questions that they ask, because I think that tells you a ton versus somebody who knows how to get through an interview from standard questions because they prepped themselves or they were prepped. I think that's huge.
Yeah. I've had people, you know, look great on paper, great on a phone call, but kind of, you know, something's a bit off. Like, I don't know if they're reading a script or something, or, and then you get them in front of you in person and then it's completely different. So
yeah,
I'm really big on kind of, you know, phone screen, in-person interview, kind of that order, because you really weed people out kind of early on that way. Another thing I like to do is really rely on R&D interns. So, you know, if you're hiring more of an entry-level role, an internship is like a long job interview, right? So you can work with someone for 3 or 6 months and really kind of tell how they work. So a lot of my entry-level people I've hired through an internship program. And then if they look good, then roll them into a full-time role.
That's awesome. So we talked a few minutes ago about how you can have two people, similar backgrounds. One, you know, continues to excel in leadership. The other one doesn't, even though they both aspire to. You could have been capped out a long time ago, too. You could have been a manager for the rest of your career, or, you know, turned back into a high-level individual contributor. Other than, you know, your first go-around with formal leadership, can you think of another moment that helped you continue to move forward? Because not everybody comes a VP, let alone a CEO, but you became a VP of R&D over time. Why? What happened? What are some moments that you think really helped catalyze that?
Sure. Yeah. I think it's a few things, kind of back to racing motorcycles. I think I'm really comfortable with risk, right? So yeah, you're right. I could have stayed an R&D manager and wrote out my career and kind of slowly climbed the corporate ladder that way. Kind of the safe bet. But there's a quote by, I think it's Mario Andretti, who's a famous race car driver, that, if you're fully comfortable, you're probably not going fast enough. So I think that applies to in life and in business, that, you know, you have to continually kind of be pushing yourself. And if you are in a super safe, comfortable spot, you know, are you really making a difference? Are you really pushing the industry and field and, you know, doing the meaningful kind of innovations? So I try to really live by that motto.
Talk more about that. You mentioned the word risk. How does it apply to what you've done over time to continue to catalyze your career?
Yeah, definitely. So, definitely going to these new startups are risky, right? So mm-hmm. There's always finite funding. Maybe the technology doesn't work. You hit a roadblock. And so I think being comfortable with risk is a big piece of it. Also, still willing to be kind of hands-on and get your hands dirty. So, we're a small startup. You still have to answer the door and go to FedEx and ship stuff. And, yeah. It's the basic stuff that people don't think about. But when you're a small team and, especially when you're first starting, you really have to be comfortable and not have a big head and not get ahead of yourself in that regard. So, I think that's a big piece of it. Another one, just, having the successful track record. So, innovation's kind of a cycle, and I've been through now a couple times. So I think that's helped me advance. I think working with people you really like, the two co-founders of Cardiac Valve Technologies are the co-founders also of Incubate, which is the incubator I'm the VP of R&D for. And so, really like working with that team. And so I think, as I get further along in my career, kind of you work with people you like again and again. And so that kind of known quantity works out.
So one comment there is, I this is my second podcast in my life. I ran another one in my former life before starting this one. But collectively, I've interviewed, 100 and almost 200 people maybe between the two. And every time I've asked about pivotal moments or why did you continue to excel, risk is the number one answer. In the sense that you stick your neck out and you take on projects that maybe is not necessarily your complete expertise or your complete wheelhouse, but maybe you joined a cross-functional team because they need extra help and you were able to, or maybe the CEO at the time asked for somebody to spearhead a project and that person stuck their neck out. And because of that, they gained visibility to on a project that was very critical to the organization. And had they not stuck their neck out, they wouldn't have gained that visibility. And before you know it, that was a turning point. And so literally almost, I think I could confidently say 100% of my interviews that I've asked that has come back to that. So
yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really a personality type, right? It's hard to learn kind of to be okay with risk. You can to some extent, I think, but some people are just kind of born with, being comfortable with a little more unknown, a little more risk. And, I always fall back on, what's the worst that could happen, right? So what's the worst that can happen is that even realistic, but if it does, there's always other jobs you can get. There's always, fall back on colleagues and other people. So, you can always get a job, I think, doing something. I'm not going to, go hungry or anything. Yeah. So what's the worst that can happen? And then you look at what's the best that can happen, right? There's a huge upside, both, financially and also just personally, kind of happiness, getting the projects across the board and making a difference in patients' lives. And so I kind of, continually weigh the risk reward. And I think that's why I'm so attracted to startups, is that the reward is just so high.
Well, so let's talk about that. You're CEO for Qantas now. When did that happen? In September, am I correct?
Yeah, just recently. So I guess maybe to back up a bit. So I joined Incubate 2 years ago now or so as the VP of R&D. And so, it's a true incubator, a bunch of different projects going on, mainly in the heart failure or structural heart space. And so been leading those projects, and Qantas was the one we've kind of got the most traction with. And, we've been kind of soft pitching these to investors and VCs and doctors and whatnot. And everyone seemed very on board and excited about the product. So we decided that's the next kind of spin out of Incubate. Mm-hmm. And so we're in the process of rolling out of Incubate, creating Qantas Cardio. That all happened in the last 3 or 4 months. We really came out of stealth. There was a cardiovascular tech forum, which is a kind of merging of, VCs and engineers and whatnot, here in Orange County. It's the third year. And so I pitched there. They had the kind of a startup contest, and we pitched there and ended up winning the Judge's Choice Award. And so from then on, that was kind of our coming out of stealth mode. And yeah, here we are. So we've got a facility now and a few engineers, and we're actively fundraising. So yeah, it's been a pretty wild last 3 or 4 months.
In your small time of being first time CEO, what has been the toughest decision you've had to make so far?
It's interesting. I think probably the team dynamics, right? Like, we're hiring a couple of people, but each hire is just so critical now, because if you get one bad apple, right, it can ruin the whole thing. So really hiring very, very carefully. You know, we've turned out some people who look really good, but I'm really happy with the team we've built now. So, you know, that's one piece of it. I think for me personally, the fundraising aspect. So we're just kind of embarking on the fundraising version, and I've been adjacent to fundraising before at my last company, Foldax, and others. But, you know, this is the first time I'm truly in charge of it and kind of reaching out myself to the VCs and strategics and whatnot. And so, yeah, there's definitely a lot of unknown there. And, you know, so far, I think so good. I think we're, you know, on track to close when we need to. But definitely the getting that going is challenging, right? There's no great kind of rule book or whatever, but I do have some great mentors helping me along the way. So Brent Ratz and Dr. Arshad Quadri, the two co-founders of Incubate, they founded Cardiac Valve Technologies, which was another startup, right, I worked at. So they're both great, great mentors. And I've kind of been around the block a few times now, so have been really helping me a lot.
It's interesting, because I was going to ask you about how the fundraising experience has been as a first, you know, basically you're the face of the business right now, and it's,
yeah,
you're out there doing it. And then you brought up mentors, which is a great segue, because I'm thinking about the election right now, right? Trump is putting together his cabinet. Every great CEO has an internal cabinet, but I think they also have an external team that they rely on, confidants, people, because they say it's lonely at the top for a reason, because it's true, right? Ultimately, yeah, the buck stops with you as the guy running the company. Talk to me a little bit about that. Who do you, and you don't have to name names, but do you have that structured in your own world as far as people who have mentored you career-wise and people who you're relying on maybe outside of the company right now as well?
Yeah, definitely. Like I mentioned, Brett and Dr. Quadri, another name that comes to mind, Alex Cooper. So he's another CEO and co-founder of another spin-out from Incubate called Relief Cardiovascular. They're right now in the process of closing their Series A. He's also a first-time CEO like me and an engineer, and we have a lot of similarities. So he's kind of where I'm at now, but, you know, 6 months ahead. So, yeah, you know, he's been a great, great friend and mentor in that regard. I also stay in touch with, my old head of R&D from EV3,
mm-hmm,
Earl Slee is his name. He's now retired, but, you know, he leads a group of, CEOs here that get together occasionally, and, you know, it's all startup CEOs that kind of, can share their struggles and that kind of private forum, which is nice. But like you said, it's kind of around over the top. Another one, my other co-founder, James Wattel, he's an engineer, brilliant guy. We've worked together in the past, our last company. He's also great kind of on the technical side, but on the fundraising and business side, yeah. So kind of growing that network, but I think it's a must have. I couldn't imagine going this completely, you know, solo without kind of some guidance.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I give you a lot of credit because, first of all, not everybody wants to become CEO. There's a lot of baggage that comes with it. But when you do, I think you got to be super, super resourceful, right? And be humble enough to know that what you don't know, you can put a resource to it, but be resourceful to find the resources that can help you do it, right?
Yeah.
It's probably a mouthful, exactly, but I think you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, you have to be, and I'm finding out more and more, you have to be so confident in every kind of vertical. You know, you have to be knowledgeable in regulatory and clinical, and really the engineering piece is the easier part for me because I'm so familiar with that. But, you know, the finances, the, you know, every aspect you kind of have to have some base level knowledge of. And then, like you said, if you don't, then have a good confidant or consultant or someone you can reach out to help educate you on that particular topic. Yeah, we've, you know, just pitching Qantas, we've been getting questions about DRG codes and reimbursement and whatnot. And that's totally, you know, it was totally outside my world and I didn't really know a ton about that. So, you know, since then, you know, been educating myself, we have a great consultant helping out. But that's just an example of something that you really have to, you don't know what you don't know, right? So
yeah,
you get these questions from VCs and you really have to make sure you're confident enough to at least speak at a certain depth for each kind of topic.
I've only got a few other questions for you, but one of the questions I was just thinking about now is, you know, you're the visionary, right? And in a startup, you sometimes also have to execute. Like you say, you go down to the post office to drop off things. Well, you do what you got to do, wear multiple hats. How far in advance are you planning?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we budget out for the next couple of years, kind of have a high-level hiring plan. And, you know, in order to come up with a target raise, right, we have a rough idea how much we need to spend to get to a first in human, for example. And yeah, I mean, there is that piece of it. But the day-to-day, you know, just frankly, I don't have the time to plan everything out exactly carefully, you know. Mm-hmm. We don't have like a super detailed kind of Gantt chart of every individual step. So a little bit of it is ad hoc, but I think it's important to at least have a vision and set goals for the team and whatnot. So you're not just running in circles and kind of putting out fires, right? You need a, you need a near-term goal, long-term goal, which we've kind of defined. So
awesome. We mentioned at the beginning, you know, your family, the fact that you've got some hobbies, you're running a startup. How do you balance everything? How do you balance work and personal?
Yeah. So it's definitely hard and still a work in progress, but I have two little girls, ages 5 and 2. So, you know, very young kids who, you know, need a lot of time. I try to set a rule for myself. I want to be home when I am not, when I'm not traveling, when I'm here, I want to be home for dinner every night. So, you know, they're young, so they eat early at, you know, 5:30 or 6. So I'll try to leave the office, be home for dinner. And then, you know, typically work after they go to bed for another hour or two to kind of catch up if needed. But really try to do that. You know, it's also kind of the modern age with COVID and working remotely and everything that kind of, you know, taught everyone that it can be done. So, you know, I don't work at 8 to 5. Sometimes I have a call at, or I'm working at 6 a.m. before they get up and just kind of doing what you need to do to carve out that family time. So I kind of carve out the morning. I do, you know, the kid drop off and whatnot, and then try to be there for dinner and bedtime. So as much as I can, although, you know, the job requires a lot of travel. So thankfully with FaceTime and whatnot, it's easy to keep in touch. But yeah, it's definitely not easy, and carving out time to, you know, stay fit and healthy and do some hobbies and stuff is even harder these days, but trying to make it work.
Do you, how do you manage the stress piece? I've said on the show multiple times, it's very difficult for me to turn off business, even with my family. It's still, you know, running in my head. How do you handle that?
Yeah. It's definitely, you know, always, a continual thing. I agree. It's really hard to turn it off. I find working out really helps that, you know? So I tell myself, you know, you the more effectively run the company, you need to be fit mentally, physically, everything, right? So going for a run or something, right? Just getting like a hard physical workout in, clear my mind. Also continuing to ride and race, right? Doing that, you have to be 100% focused on what you're doing. And there's no time or brain kind of bandwidth to do anything else. So just being like out of every zone and just focusing on one thing for that hour or so, I think really kind of clears your head. So I try to do that as much as I can fit in.
It's funny you said that about racing, because I'm not an excessive gambler by any means, but it's a guilty pleasure. So I like to play blackjack ever so often. And that's like one of the only times that I don't think about anything else, because you have to concentrate and you have to count your cards and understand what's going on. It's like, that's an escape. It's an escape.
You gotta be all in, right?
Yeah. So I hear you on that, man. And I give you credit as far as trying to be a present father to the best of your ability, because time goes fast. My boys are 7 and 9, and I think, how in the heck is that even possible? So
yeah, definitely.
Anything, I guess, you know, you guys have so many great things going for you as far as Incubate behind you. You're working on your fundraising, you're hiring, a lot of great stuff. Is there anything in particular that you're most excited about with what's going on with Qantas right now?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the next year is going to be really exciting, right? So we have a great kind of proof of concept, but you know, we're doing our first chronic animal studies early next year. And so this will be our first kind of feedback on how it works on a long term in these kind of heart failure animals. And so that's really the last piece, is kind of proving the efficacy in the animal models. And then, yeah, really hitting the ground hard next year, fundraising. You know, we're targeting to close our Series A mid next year.
Nice.
And so, yeah, I think we're at a kind of tipping point. I have the team here. We have the facility. We have the design. So everything's kind of hitting on all gears. And so, yeah, it should be really exciting next 6 months to a year. And then following that, you know, in 2026, you know, we should be doing our first in human implants. And so seeing it actually help patients, I think, is the most excited part of any program I've been a part of, is seeing it a person helping to change their life.
That's amazing. What great motivation too, to kind of keep the long-term, you know, vision in mind and where this is headed.
Yeah.
I give you a lot of credit, man. It's been a pleasure having you. I appreciate all the nuggets that you've shared. One last question. Are you a reader by chance, or do you listen to books, or?
Yeah, definitely.
Any inspirational books that you'd recommend the audience to read or check out?
You know, I just read the David Goggins' new book. He's an ex-Navy SEAL guy, ultra-marathoner, and really about kind of mindset. His first book was called Can't Hurt Me, I believe. So really, really good. I mean, definitely a different perspective, and he's one of those, you know, like his kind of motto is, be abnormal amongst the abnormal. So, you know, it really takes a lot to do what we do and kind of help change therapy and develop these devices and whatnot. So, and I think it's really a kind of inspirational way of thinking, is that, you know, you really have to put yourself out there and do things that others aren't willing to do, or take risks that others aren't willing to do. So yeah, Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you being a valued guest on the show. And if it's cool with you, we'll make sure that we leave a link to your LinkedIn profile so that folks can connect as they see fit.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Garrett.
All right. Thanks, Mitch. See you.
Thanks for listening to the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. For more content-rich episodes, log on to theanthonymichaelgroup.com or subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform.